It's time for Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you have a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now at 252-222-4848.
And we'd like to welcome Cecil Harvell from Harvell and Collins, who's joining us on the phone this morning. Good morning, counselor. How are you?
Hello.
There you are, Cecil.
Good morning.
Cecil, you know, our show last week was very enlightening when you and Wes were talking about just breaking down, you know, what the attorney fees cost. And I had a lot of people remark after the show to me when I was going around town that they found it very informative, that there's this misconception that legal services are just out of reach for the common man. And it's really not the case. And you really brought that to light last week in last week's show. I just wanted to compliment you on that topic. And it really resonated with many of the listeners that I see every day out and about.
Well, good. Yeah. Mike, I think the main thing with that, and then we'll move to my subject of the morning,
sure.
But the primary thing that would need to be communicated is that folks just need to ask. They really need to make inquiries. They need to ask their questions. They need to call a lawyer. The receptionist, of course, are well-trained in the area of what is this going to cost, how long will it take, things of that nature, and don't be afraid to make a call.
Right.
And ask your questions about what things will cost,
mm-hmm.
what the structure of the financial arrangement will be. Okay. So, you know, hiring a lawyer is just like anything else that we do. We certainly need to know, you know, what it's going to cost and what the terms of the financial arrangement would be. And so my encouragement to everyone is don't be afraid of lawyers. Don't be fearful of this subject. We're used to answering these questions.
Mm-hmm.
We get them every single day. And so don't be one of these people that put off what you might need
yeah.
in terms of legal services for fear of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
You might be very fortunately and graciously surprised.
Yeah, doesn't hurt to ask. So,
yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Mike, I just want to recapture here a little bit this morning, a new topic. Just kind of go through the real basics, the ABC. We don't have but so much time
mm-hmm.
of just what the probate process is.
Okay.
Probate seems to always kind of, you know, it's kind of unfortunately, it's a dirty word, and it really isn't a dirty word. It's really a very logical procedure. Clearly, when we lose a loved one, there has to be a legal procedure to change the title to
mm-hmm.
a home, to a lot in a subdivision, to a car, to a bank account, to a stock or a bond that we might own, to any kind of annuity or life insurance. Clearly, someone has died, and there now has to be a legal process by which the title to all of these various assets, which change from estate to estate. Some people don't have all of the things that I mentioned. They might just have one or two of those items.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever they have that is in their name, being that they are now no longer living, the title to that asset is going to need to change. And changing the title to an asset is basically the process of probate. Probate is, in fact, the legal changing of title to assets.
Okay.
And it begins by someone either through the will, who is the executor, or a family member, if there is no will, qualifying with the clerk of court in the county where the person died as the CEO, if you will, of the estate. They then get letters, testamentary, if they are the executor, or letters of administration, if they are the administrator. And this then is their authority, Mike. This is the ticket. This is the authority for them to go to the bank, go to the Department of Motor Vehicles, register a deed in the courthouse, changing the title of the asset out of the name of the person who we have lost into the name of the beneficiary,
okay.
and or beneficiary if there's just one. And that's a very simple thing to do. You know, these, again, the motor vehicles, Department of Motor Vehicles, the Register of Deeds, the banks, your stock companies, they all have a great deal of experience in receiving this letter's testamentary, and they know what to do about it. They know how to change the title and how to go about doing that. And so what the probate process is basically opening up an estate and then marshaling together the assets, kind of inventorying what they are. That's where we use the U.S. mail, by the way, and we look at the tax returns, because if you get the mail of an individual and you review their tax return, then you really are going to get a wealth of information.
Yeah.
And then you begin slowly but surely taking each respective asset, be it a car, be it, you know, a bank account, an annuity, a life insurance, whatever it happens to be. You'll get notice of that in the mail over a period of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months. And then one by one, item by item, you slowly but surely change the title of that asset to the beneficiary. This is, in fact, Mike, what we call probate. And it really is not quite as burdensome or quite as a bad word as it's made out to be.
Well, let me ask you just a basic question, because for a lot of people, it's unfamiliar terrain they're going to be walking through, and they're not used to this. You are, because you do this every day. But let's just say that your mother, your only parent dies. So you have the mourning process, you have the funeral. At what point do you start the probate process? Is there a statute as far as time as when this should start, and how long do you have to work out all of those things you just mentioned as far as, you know, picking them off one by one? When do you start?
The answer is that the law doesn't really set forth a deadline, if you will, or you know, a statute of limitations, if you will. But the practical answer is that it needs to be done, you know, just as soon as practicable. We can't really officially open up an estate until we have a death certificate.
Okay.
But many, many times family members will come into the office or give a call, begin to ask some preliminary questions, you know, before the death certificate actually comes, which, as we know, can be like, say, a week, maybe 10 days after a death. Folks many times have questions at the funeral home, in terms of, you know, even at the funeral home, sometimes who has the authority to sign for the cremation or sign for the burial. So we can get questions, into the office pretty quickly, actually. Sometimes, of course, Mike, also people will call us in advance and they will let us know that their loved one is in hospice or their loved one is not going to make it or whatever the case might be. The answer really to the question is sooner the better, because we want to kind of get organized. We want to get a handle on the assets, and kind of be able to lock down, if you will, some of the decisions. For instance, a car that is in the name of a decedent really shouldn't be driven. What if there's a liability occurrence with that automobile?
Mm-hmm.
A home that is in the name of the decedent, you know, we need to secure that home. What if there's a break-in? Do the locks need to be changed? Things of that nature. So the sooner the better, but sometimes, you know, folks will wait for whatever reason, and we might not be contacted until, you know, 2 or 3 months goes by. Many times, Mike, those files, I got a phone call just yesterday like that from a son, an adult son. He has one brother, and they've lost their mother.
Right.
And they had not done anything for, you know, a couple of months, 2 to 3 months, let's say. And the reason being is that they really did not think there was anything to do.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a home that needed to be locked. There was a car, but they just simply were not real sure that it was necessary to open up an estate, and so they just didn't do anything for a couple of months. And now, of course, here we are now going to begin the process for them.
Yeah. It is a complicated, it seems complicated to the outsider, but if you, you know, like you say, you do it every day, it isn't, you just got to take it as it comes, one step at a time, but do it sooner rather than later, the probate process. Interesting.
Well, I think what helps is for folks to understand kind of what I many times call the big picture. I mean, a lot of folks just don't understand why there even needs to be a process. And of course, clearly we don't want just anybody, you know, going into a bank and claiming money, you know, claiming a CD, transferring an automobile hither and yon, being able to prepare a deed to a property and maybe there's been a title defect. I mean, there has to be legal documentation for these things to occur. And so fortunately, we have lots of guidelines and lots of structure that's out there to help folks, you know, get through the changing of the title of the assets of their loved one. That's basically what this thing is all about, I like to say, is changing the title of an asset from the person who has died to the appropriate and respective beneficiary or beneficiaries.
And the other thing that, you know, there's a lot of things that happen when a loved one passes, but you're talking about tangible items such as the car, such as the home, but the person's taxes as well, does that play into probate or is that a separate animal altogether as far as their filing of taxes or all of that?
No, that is part of the process, and that actually is something that can sometimes, you know, kind of hold up that final letter of closure on an estate. For instance, right now, I have a nice lady calling in saying, our 3 months has gone by. I really want to close my brother's estate. Let's go ahead and get that done here, you know, in the late days of August. Well, I then, of course, had to explain to her that, but there's a tax return. Mm-hmm. And because your brother lived, you know, through much of 2021, and you know, the information for that tax return, you're not going to get until January, February of 2022. And so we're going to have to wait for all of that information to come in from his investment accounts, et cetera, and file his final tax return. And we need the estate to still be open for that purpose. So, for instance, Mike, all the title to the assets in that estate have been changed.
Mm-hmm.
The car, the bank account, the stocks, everything that gentleman owned has been changed. The title has been changed and has been completed appropriately. And the one item that's kind of lingering that's holding us up is the filing of the tax return. But see, there you go. We go back to the very beginning. Who has the authority to sign that tax return? Obviously, the person who has the authority to sign it is the executor of the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And so the estate needs to be open and in good standing at the time that the executor signs the tax return. So tax filings are a critical component of settling the estate of our loved one, and it's certainly an issue that's out there that we look at very carefully.
I can see the need for counsel if the situation goes beyond just a car and a family home. People can have property in many states. They can have assets scattered throughout the United States or businesses. And I'm curious to know how that would all play out. Let's maybe touch on that subject, if it's okay, when we come back from this break here. We'll take our short time out here with Cecil Harvell from Harvell & Collins. If you'd like to reach the firm, call them today, 252-726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We'll take a short time out here and be back with Cecil after this quick timeout. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, and Cecil Harvell's with us this morning talking about the probate process. Cecil, I guess a simple question, it'll be very simple to you, but maybe to some out there may not know the answer to this. The probate process, you talk a lot about the clerk of the court. Which court does one go to start the probate process?
The general rule is that the probate process is going to happen in the county where the decedent, where our lost person, if you will, our dead person, was living at the time that they died. In other words, where their residency was.
Their primary residence.
Their primary residency.
Okay.
So now there you go, and there's the answer to the question.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, however, Mike, let's go a little bit further. Sometimes it's not quite so easy to know what the residency happens to be. In other words, suppose mom and dad or mom is living here in Moorhead City. She's been living here for a long, long time. But for the last year, she's gone to Raleigh to be with her daughter or her son because she was failing so very significantly, and they want her to live in their home for the last part of her life. Suppose she moves temporarily into a hospice in a different county or into a nursing facility in a different county because there's one not available here in Carteret County, and she's at the VA in Lenoir County. Okay, so residency is not where one physically dies. That is not residency. Residency has two elements. Number one is, yes, where someone might physically be, but number two, what is their intention? Where did they really consider their home to be? And where did they maintain addresses and driver's licenses? And where did they own property, you know, like as in a home, things of that nature? So we have a lot of files where we will handle an estate in Carteret County because that was the intention of what Mr. and Mrs. Jones called home. But yet maybe they haven't, quote, been home for the last, say, 2 or 3 years because they have been, you know, in a nursing facility or in a rehab center or in a hospice or with a child that lives in a different area.
Who makes that determination then?
Well, the clerk of court. The clerk of court would consider all of those circumstances and make a decision as to whether or not the sufficiency of residency venue, actually is what it's called, is sufficient to ask to open the estate in Carteret County.
I see. Okay. So you'd go to our Carteret County clerk of court here and make your appeal to Clerk Raper and take it
right.
from there.
Right. The death certificate might say, you know, the debt will not, it won't might, it will definitely have on it the physical address, potentially, of the place where our loved one died. And maybe that then is Wake County, you know, or Lenoir County. And so there's, you know, it's not Carteret County, but it also then, so there might be a question about where did the person consider their home to be, what were the incidents of ownership that they had in the county, in the county, things of that nature. And without pretty much delay, without any delay, you know, that would create a circumstance where the estate could get opened in Carteret County. But generally speaking, the answer to your question is in the county of the residency of the decedent. And then the clerk of court in that particular county takes charge and guides people through the process.
Okay.
I might also say, Mike, you made the comment, you know, that legal help. We have a lot of folks that we see initially. I mean, it's almost at this point, you know, maybe even, you know, 50-50 or certainly 40-60% where we do not necessarily have to engage them as clients. They do not have to engage us as a lawyer. They are able to handle the estate through the assistance of the clerk of court or the assistant clerks in the estates division of each county. These assistant clerks are wonderful. They're quite knowledgeable. They are able to help people through the process. They will be very quick to tell you that they aren't lawyers, and sometimes they will get into the middle of a file, a middle of a state, and they will run into a wrinkle, and they'll say to the executor, well, now, you know, Mr. Jones, you really are now going to need to consult with a lawyer. I can't help you with that particular issue. But every estate does not, Mike, require the assistance or professional guidance of a lawyer. Not every estate is at the level where it needs that kind of guidance.
What's a reasonable time frame, Cecil, for someone that's going through this and a do-it-yourselfer, with a typical household and the assets? What's a reasonable time frame one can expect from the beginning of this process to its conclusion?
Well, we begin with the time frame that a lot of folks know, which is that there's a 3 month statute of limitations, if you will, for creditors of an estate to make a claim and to make themselves known to the executor that they believe that they have a claim. This, of course, is after the notification in the newspaper, that's the official newspaper of that county, that the loved one has died and that the advertisement is now running, setting forth a 3 month deadline. And so for the first 3 months, after someone dies, or basically 3 months after the running of the advertisement in the newspaper, you really cannot close an estate. You have to leave it open for at least that period of time so as to receive creditors. Now, some people will do a small estate, or they will not necessarily open up a full estate, and they won't take advantage of this 3 month statute of limitations. We as a law firm don't particularly like that. We prefer to put our clients in a position where absolutely no one is going to come knocking on the door, you know, a year or two later, saying that Mr. Jones owed me some money. Right. Let's go ahead and take advantage of the North Carolina law that allows this 3 month statute to be in place and then allow it to expire and bar the creditors. So we are a proponent of opening an estate sometimes just for that purpose.
Makes sense.
So we have that initial 3 months. We then have this tax return issue that I mentioned to you earlier, Mike. But the general rule of thumb is, I would say, 4 to 6 months, 4 to 6 months, maybe 9 months, depending on the tax issues. But let's hasten to say, Mike, that doesn't mean that we're working transferring assets 9 months after someone dies. That's just when we can get a letter of closure. The assets are going to transfer very, very promptly, weeks, you know, a month, 2 months. Very, very soon, the assets are going to be marshaled together and organized and made ready to transfer. That process doesn't take 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's the holdup of mostly the tax filings or waiting on certain documentation or something like that that might cause an estate to stay open, a 9 month period.
That makes perfect sense. And Cecil, we skipped over this break, so I'm going to give you the remaining about 70 or 80 seconds to close out and wrap up and little takeaway from today's conversation about the probate process. And I'll give it to you. You have 70 seconds.
Well, I'll loop back to the very beginning where you were mentioning, you know, lawyer fees. And last week, Wes and I kind of tried to demystify some of that. If you are, a citizen and you've lost a loved one and you don't really know whether or not you need a lawyer to help you with an estate, you don't know what it might cost to have a lawyer help you with the estate, then those are the kinds of things that you seek a consultation about. Most lawyers do not charge for the initial consultation. And after an hour or so with a lawyer, the lawyer is going to be able to tell you an estimate of what he or she thinks the file might cost and whether or not you even need a lawyer to begin with. So again, don't be hesitant. Don't be fearful of just seeking out basic legal advice, and then you kind of take it from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with that free consultation and that hour or so time, you can get some guidelines and some direction. And like you said, many of these cases, files are rather simple that the person can do on their own, but as long as they have that knowledge. And then you're there as well to step in and guide them through those challenging processes at Harvell & Collins. Again, very enlightening show today, Cecil. I appreciate your time and bringing this subject, the probate process, to light. Thank you, Cecil.